There were many projects that Terry has undertaken over his career, both his initial career at Johns Hopkins and later here at the Salk Institute. Some of them have continued the early work on how neural nets might learn and remember. One of the early papers, in fact, it was the paper where I first learned of Terry and consequently ended up meeting him, was a paper that he did with Dana Ballard and Jeff Hinton, where they used simulated annealing as a method for teaching a neural network. In any case, he proceeded then to do all kinds of work on neural nets of varying kinds, realized that we needed to know the details at the neurobiological level of how it is that neurons might change in response to a stimulus. And at about that time, people were learning about LTP. And Terry realized that if you had something like LTP, where the synapses were potentiated, you probably also had something like long-term depression, where there was a decoupling of strength between the synapses. And he was really the first person to propose that, to look for it, and to find it. He also went on to do work on sleep and the role of various rhythms in sleep and how that might be related to learning and memory. Just a vast amount of work. But part of the point, I don't want to go through all of the projects, but part of what I wanted to say here was that a theme that you see kind of right from the beginning and that has never ceased to be a really important theme is that Terry realized that in some way or other, brains care deeply about time and about the timing of events within the cell or at the level of the whole neuron, at the level of the neural network, and so forth. And this was at a stage in neuroscience where I think it hadn't really occurred to most people that time sensitivity was going to turn out to be such a crucial and major issue. And now, of course, I think most of us in the field really do understand that, and it has become one of those areas of research where we feel like we know very little, but many of the really important answers are likely to come out of issues having to do with time. So, having got you to that point then, Terry has given you some information here. His lab is the Computational Neuroscience Lab, which is housed in the Salk Institute, but he is also a faculty member at the University of California in San Diego. I guess you're probably going to talk a little bit about the original paper that called A Critique of Pure Vision. So what I think I'll do now then is just turn it over to you, Terry. Thanks.
Great. So thanks very much, Pat, for that introduction. And with the time that remains, I'll start by saying that coming here to San Diego really was a turning point in this saga that Pat was outlining for you, because of the fact that it was the transition between thinking about patterns of activity in nets as populations of neurons representing complex objects, as you'll see today, to thinking about how that activity is regulated, how it not just represents things in the world, but how you can use it in order to compute over time. And that's really been the theme in my lab over the last 17 years. And in fact, it was that transition point that Pat and I collaborated together on the computational brain, which really brought together the idea that we have to go beyond the single neuron. We have to think about large numbers of neurons interacting together over time. And that's really where I think neuroscience, the techniques in neuroscience now have finally caught up with us. And this is a really exciting era because for the first time, we're getting a chance to see, because of the ability to record from hundreds of neurons simultaneously and the ability that we have to analyze the data using advanced algorithms like independent component analysis and many others, that we are actually getting finally a glimpse of what's really happening inside the brain. Now, should I turn the lights down a little bit? Would that help people see the screen?
Yeah, that would be pretty good.
Okay. So, the paper that, it was actually a book chapter that was in a book that Christoph Koch edited called Large-Scale Neuronal Theories of the Brain, a very pretentious title. And it actually was came out of a meeting he had organized. And I think that book, in one way, provided an excuse for us to think about the problem of vision, to rethink it, really, to go over all of the evidence from many different angles, from the psychophysical angle, what do we know about what humans can actually perceive, under what conditions, from the physiological level, let's look at, in fact, what people have learned from recording from one neuron at a time, starting with Hubel and Wiesel in the visual system, and then also looking at it from an anatomical and a computational perspective. What is the function of those circuits, and what can we say about how it is all integrated together? And it was really a vast amount of literature that we surveyed, and at the end of the day, when we finally finished the chapter, I think what we had concluded was that the field had really gone astray, that they had made assumptions they weren't even aware of, and this was really constraining a new view of what vision might actually be there for. And at the time, I think the chapter, and in fact, is it true, Pat, that John Jacobson told me that this is probably one of the most cited papers on your CV? Well, same is true with me, and then part of the reason is that it got people to think about it. Now, this particular talk is one that I put together this for a meeting that I was invited to attend this last summer at Dartmouth. It was a meeting which was organized to celebrate the 50th anniversary of artificial intelligence here in the U.S. Some of the British colleagues pointed out that actually had started in England a bit earlier. But this was a famous meeting that took place in 1956, where, and it wasn't a meeting actually, it turned out to have been a summer workshop that lasted for several months, during which people came through, you know, a week at a time. And it was a very exciting time because if you think back to that era, it was computers had become available for the first time to researchers. They were beginning to program them to do interesting things, like, for example, the theorem prover of Newell and Simon, or to play games. People were working on, for example, backgammon and chess. And Marvin Minsky was there, and John McCarthy. It was an exciting time because it looked as if they finally had, first of all, the machine, the computer, but also they had a theory. And the theory was you build intelligence out of logic. And of course, that's what computers are really good at, right? Binary switches. So it looked great. It looked like it was really exciting. And now fast forward 50 years later, where are we? This meeting had been organized, and in fact, there were like four or five people from the original group at Dartmouth who were there at this meeting, and a lot of the talks were given by students of those pioneers, and covered the waterfront in terms of different areas of artificial intelligence. And I was asked to give the talk about the brain, so that's what I tried to do. I tried to survey, you know, what we knew about over the last 50 years. What have we gained? What knowledge have we gained? And I was reminded by something that Alan Newell once told me. Alan Newell was one of the pioneers. He was at Carnegie Mellon University, and he actually, more than most of the people in AI, actually did care about constraints that came from behavior in the brain. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, it looked as if there was an exciting moment there, but an artificial intelligence seemed to have turned its back on the brain. And he said that, well, that's not really what happened. He said that he personally was very interested in the brain. However, not enough was known at the time to offer help and guidance. And then it's true, back in the 50s, right, we barely knew what a synapse was. We barely knew about how action potentials work from the work of Katz and Hodgkin and Huxley. And it, very, very little was known about neural circuitry, but it was a very early stage. And so as a consequence, they felt that it was a bit premature to be trying to think about how the brain worked. since so little was known about it, let's see how much progress we could make just by looking at basic principles and taking an engineering approach. And it was only the next generation that where it turned from not enough is known, so let's wait, to we don't need to look at the brain, right? It's irrelevant. And that transformation, which took place in AI, really led it down a garden path. And the meeting was really exciting because all the people who had taken different garden paths had come back with the very same message, basically, is that it was a much more difficult problem than we ever imagined. It's required enormously more powerful computers to make any progress at all. We're finally getting to the point where we understand the magnitude of the problem, and we are making some progress. And I'll tell you a bit later what that progress was. But now I want to get back to vision and think about this from the perspective of computer vision. But as you'll see, this in fact represents an assumption that's made not just by engineers, but by neuroscientists who think about vision. It's in fact an assumption which is so deeply embedded in the way that we think about sensory processing that it's hard to even imagine that it could be wrong. Okay. So this is actually, I looked very hard through Marr and I couldn't find a nice crisp statement of it, but it's represented throughout his book. This is from a review by Aliamonos and Rosenfeld, who were at the University of Maryland, and they really nailed it. So this is what a lot of people believe. So what's the goal of vision? So regarding the central goal of vision as scene recovery makes sense. Scene recovery is taking everything in front of you and trying to understand how the two-dimensional array on your retina should be interpreted as objects in a three-dimensional setting. If we are able to create, using vision, an accurate representation of the three-dimensional world and its properties, then using this information, we can perform any visual task. What could be more obvious, right? And this is, in fact, the way that AI was conceived. It was conceived of as a modular subject. There are people working on vision. There are other people working on the motor system. Those are the roboticists. Then there are other people working on planning. And there are other people who are working on how is it that you solve a reason about the problem domain. And that made a lot of sense because, you know, you try to chop a problem up into pieces that you can focus on. And in terms of the stream of information that's flowing in, the idea was that the vision people would solve that problem and they would then pass off some very high level representation, but it would be purely visual, right? And it would be veridical in the sense that this little model that you're creating with geometry, with all of the, you know, the beauty of mathematics, would you just be able to measure, for example, distances in this model, and that would tell the roboticist who's creating an arm that's going to solve the equations of motion exactly how far the arm has to be moved to get to a point in space where an object is located, right? So all you have to do is send over the coordinates, and that's the interface between the vision module and the motor module, right? Seems nice and clean. And in fact, there's an anecdote, and I thought it was one of these made-up stories, but it turns out that there's some truth to it. The anecdote is that when AI Lab that Minsky founded got its first grant from DARPA, the goal was to create a ping pong machine that could play ping pong. And indeed, they got the money for it. It arrived, and they realized they had forgotten to ask for any money to put together a vision system. And so they assigned it to a graduate student for a summer project. So I actually, Mark Minsky was there, and I actually asked him, I said, is it true? He said, well, it's not completely true. It is true that we did get this grant for this project, and it's true that we forgot about the vision system. And is that the time for the next meeting? We have a temporal dynamics of learning meeting. I think it's coming up soon. But he said, it's not true. We did not assign a grad student to the project for the summer. We assigned an undergraduate. And what this all illustrates, though, is the lesson that should be learned from this, really, and it hasn't really sunk in yet, and that is that our intuition about what's difficult and what's easy is really misled us. Because we're so good at seeing, because of the fact that it doesn't take any mental effort for me to look out and recognize Pat sitting there or where my computer is, it all seems to be in front of me and it's all perfectly clear. But that's the simplicity of that, you have to realize, is based on the fact that half of your cortex is designed to process vision. And primates are especially visual animals, so it's not too surprising we're good at it. And the things that we thought were really, really difficult, you know, the ones that require the highest level of human achievement, for example, being a mathematician and proving theorems, or playing chess. Well, we know now that we have machines that can play chess at the grandmaster level, right? They're not doing it the same way the grandmaster's doing it, but nonetheless, that has turned out to be a less difficult problem than seeing, which has not been solved yet. We cannot create a robot that goes around through the world and is able to do as well as you do, let alone as well as a baby does, right? Babies already can do much better than most of our vision systems. So something is wrong, and I think it's actually wrong right here. I think that this way of thinking about vision has really led us to interpret a lot of the data from neuroscience, and also has, I think, led computer vision people to attempt to solve a problem which may be impossible. In fact, it may be so difficult that it's not even worth doing it in the way that they hoped to do it at the very beginning, and thought it would be an easy summer project. So let's think about this now. I've given you sort of the history in AI. Let's go through the history on the neuroscience side. So if we think about these different levels of investigation and think about the visual system superimposed on this, right? Ultimately, the single unit, you know, the neuron, really has told us the most about how neurons represent information in the visual system. So let's start there. So we know, what do we know? We know that at the level of the retina, that there's an array of 100 million photoreceptors, and then that array, which is like not quite like the pixels in the camera, because there's already a lot of processing going on even in the photoreceptors, but behind that there's a very, very sophisticated machine, enormously highly evolved, to take that information and then process it, compress it down to a optic nerve that has about 1 million ganglion cells taking information from there into the brain. And we know that the level of the ganglion cell, the pattern of light that they respond to best is circular. They have small little centers, which are excitatory in the sense that if you shine a small spot, the ganglion cell will fire at a high frequency. By the way, this was first discovered by Steve Kuffler, recording from single ganglion cells in the cat retina. And that goes back to the 50s. So it's like 56, I think, or 7. And then around that is another circular annulus, which is inhibitory in the sense that if you shine the light there, it reduces the firing rate. So, but at that level of the early sensory processing, there's a lot of machinery that's there to help increase the flow of information, to code it in a way that's very efficient. And this turns out to be, we know, one of the important ingredients, the center surround geometry. Now, what was exciting back in the early 60s was when Hubel and Wiesel for the first time recorded from single neurons in the visual cortex, V1, primary visual cortex, which had a topographic representation of the retina, but it was distorted because it represented the central fovea much more highly in terms of the number of cells. But what they reported was that, unlike the retina, which had these circular receptive fields, in the cortex, the receptive fields are elongated, that the cells there prefer to have bars of light falling like this, for example, for this cell, or like this, or some other angle, or edges, dark and then light, would give a nice response for this particular cell. And this was synthesized by virtue of the connectivity pattern. So this is actually a little diagram from the 1962 Hubel and Wiesel paper, in which they suggested that it was a convergence of cells coming from the retina and through the thalamus that would converge by virtue of the inputs into layer 4 onto one of these cortical cells that would synthesize this particular pattern. A lot of evidence has built up over the last 50 years to actually suggest that they were, to a first approximation, probably right, although the connections within the cortex turn out to be very important too. About 99% of all of the synapses in the cortex are coming from other cortical cells. The degree of connectivity is very, very high there. But that's just the first stage of processing. Now, the interpretation that Hubel and Wiesel gave to their results and has really been adopted is that here we have this beautiful machine that's going to extract features, important features from the world that are relevant for recognizing objects. And what could be more important than the outline of the object? So you can imagine that this cell would fire, for example, if this was the edge of my hand sitting here, right? And you can connect the dots and figure out, you know, that there's an object there by virtue of its contour. And that then leads to the next idea. Well, okay, once you've gotten the simple features that are local, only in a small part of the visual field, and in the case of the visual cortex, this is a degree or less near the fovea, now you have to somehow connect the dots, and the way you do that is by transforming that first level of representation to a more complex one, where we have cells, for example, V1 topographically projects to V2, where now we find cells that have larger receptive fields and are more specific about what type of stimulus drives them. It has to have not just the right shape, but has to have the right color and perhaps other properties, three-dimensional properties. And this continues up the hierarchy, and we now know there are several dozen of these visual areas in different parts of the cortex, and in one stream, the one that goes ventrally toward the infratemporal cortex goes through V4, and then various parts of the infratemporal cortex, and then at the very end, we find cells whose receptive field is so large it spans the entire visual field, and so specific in their response properties that they will only fire if a very specific object, like a hand or a face, or something that you can recognize as an object, is in the visual field. So these are the so-called grandmother cells, right? A cell that only fires when your grandmother comes into the room. And so this, of course, is very appealing. It's a bottom-up idea. The idea is that the information flows from the retina, bang, 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 straight through to the point where you have cells that recognize complex objects. Well, it's such an appealing idea that the people in computer vision actually tried to build it, right? They tried to create these filters. Of course, they didn't use neurons. They used different algorithms. And they eventually were able to partially solve some of these problems, but they ran into one technical problem after another. So it turns out that these edge detectors, for example, you might think that, well, gee, they're great for getting the outline, but if you actually use them on an image, and a natural image that includes things like texture on the table or wood or leaves, turns out that they are as active, in fact, more active when they're confronted with a textured surface than they are at the outline. So it turns out that if you want the outline, you look for the place where there's where the edge detectors aren't firing, because that's a subset of measure 1, the outline, compared to the area, which is much greater. So it turns out that texture turns out to be a much better way to distinguish object from background if you have good texture detectors. So a lot of things that were not intuitive and not understood really were learned by trial and error. But it really, I think, has been one of these garden paths. And the rest of the lecture is going to be trying to replace the garden path with another one, or maybe maybe something that will be more bottom up in terms of thinking. Now, what do I mean by that? So let's look just now at numbers, some numbers. So let's get some constraints from the hardware. We know there are about 100 billion neurons in the brain, which is a very, very large number, right, 100 billion. However, if I had a dollar for every neuron in your brain, I couldn't cover this year's national budget deficit. So, you know, it's not really an astronomical number. It's a number that we already have thinking in terms of things that we can actually build. Now, the neuron is really important for signaling, especially over long distances, but a lot of processing takes place within the neuron, and it's really the synapses, the connections between them, that's really the key computational step. Excitatory, inhibitory, neuromodulatory, many different types of synapses, and the numbers are truly staggering. Each neuron connects up to about 10,000 others, so we have about 10 to the 15th synapses. And each one of those neurons is firing at an average about 1 a second, some a lot higher, but most some a lot less, say on average. And that gives us a huge bandwidth. I mean, this bandwidth, 10 to 15 bits per second, turns out to be comparable to the entire bandwidth of the internet, or the backbone of the internet. You know, so it turns out that, you know, even with modern technology, if you add up everything we've got, the whole planet, it's only barely coming up to speed with what we have in our brains. Super miniaturized 3D interconnect technology in a little package that runs on, you know, a couple tens of watts. Wow, that's a real technology. So part of the problem is that we have, right now, we're just using a lot of energy dissipating this heat. And now if we think that these synapses actually store the memory, and it's not the only place that memories are stored, but we have lots of bits. So we have lots of ways that we could use the machinery. However, here's the problem. The problem is that if you look at the problem of trying to recognize images, you might say, okay, well, fine. We have all the synapses and everything. Why not just memorize everything? Just take, you know, all the images you've seen, store them away in a file somewhere, you know, and when you get a new one, just compare them all. And that sounds kind of silly, especially when you start thinking about how many possible images there are, right? So if there are 10 to the 100 million photoreceptors, that's 10 to the 8th. And let's just assume that the gray level can be 10 different levels, right? So the number of possible images is something like 10 to the 10th to the 8th. That's a huge number. In fact, mathematicians have a number that they call a Google. By the way, this is the correct spelling. you might be confused by a company that has a similar name. And a Google is defined as 10 to the 100th. So the number of possible images, and by the way, most of them are garbage, right? But they're random. But that nonetheless is what you're up against, is anything could happen. It's a lot bigger than a Google. In fact, it is in the same range as a Googleplex, which is 10 to a Google. Right? So this is a very, very difficult problem. And it's not, and unless you really are clever about solving it, you're going to be in trouble. And this reminds me of Leslie Orgel's second law. So when I first came to the SALK, Francis explained this to me. He said that, well, Leslie Orgel's one of the smartest people I've ever met. And he has these two laws, and that I should be aware of them. And so Leslie Orgel's second law is that nature is more clever than Leslie Orgel. And what that points out is that, you know, when we actually come down and figure out how nature solved the problem, it's not the way that we would have done it. It doesn't make any sense to us. It's because it doesn't use standard engineering procedures or common sense and so forth. But once the mechanism is understood and you understand that evolution got it to where it is, you appreciate how clever nature must have been along the way to create a retina and to create a cortex. But the point is that we shouldn't prejudge it. We understand what the function is or how it was designed, because that's not something that is constrained. If the constraints are back in, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago that animals had when they were trying to find food and so forth, that we may not be, even be aware of. And that's why this diagram, which is taken from Marr's book, is so important. So David Marr, who was very influential in vision, wrote a book called Vision in 1981. also have the idea that we have to think in terms of levels and specifically how you analyze a problem. So his view was that what you do is you start with the computational level. His view was you do it top down. That if you don't understand what the problem is ahead of time, it's hopeless to think that you can at the end figure out how to actually solve it. So you start out with a definition of what the task is and what the output should be. What is it you're trying to, the behavior you're trying to perform, or what is it that the machine is supposed to spit out at the end? And then think of all the algorithms, all the procedures, the recipes for actually going about step by step and solving it. You pick one of those that looks like it might be fast or efficient or whatever for whatever reason, and you implement it. And implement it, again, you can implement it as a computer program. You could build a machine out of cans, that analog machine that actually does the same thing, or you can build it out of neurons. You know, at this point, you know, it depends on what tools you have available and what's easy and what's cheap. Now, what's different about the diagram is the part that I added, right? His part was this arrowhead and this arrowhead. My change was to make them bidirectional. Why? Well, the reason is that we may not actually know. And as I was saying, we may be misled into thinking we know what the actual function or computation is that the system is trying to produce. All we have available is some intuitions. But you know, there's no reason why nature should have evolved good intuitions for how the brain works, right? In fact, that would be unnecessary, be burdening us with information that we don't need, right? We just see. That's the thing that allows us to survive. And similarly, if you think that this algorithm is really pretty because you can implement it on your digital computer, which is a serial machine, that may not be the most efficient one if you have a parallel machine. So it turns out that the machine you have available constrains what algorithms you're going to explore, right? So why was it that in the early days of artificial intelligence, people came up with rule-based systems? Well, the reason is that the computers were so slow back then. They were running, you know, a few hundred or thousands of instructions per second, right? Now we have things going at, you know, 10 to the 12th, you know, terahertz, in terms of the number of processing steps. But if you have a machine that's really slow, you better use a sequential algorithm, right, to take advantage of it. In fact, you better use a binary logical approach for representation, because that's the only thing your machine is going to be able to run in a reasonable amount of time. So although they thought, and this is the unfortunate part, they actually had convinced themselves, the pioneers, that we're using a machine which in principle should be able to compute any computable function, right? The Turing machine. And the digital computer is like a small version of that, you know, with finite memory and so forth. But you know, if we can compute anything, we can certainly compute vision, right? That's one of the things that is computable, we imagine. So we're fine. But what they were really buying into was a really, really constrained version, because their imagination couldn't go beyond that simple, you know, rule by rule by rule step. Because you know, if your whole research is based on that starting point, then you know, you're cutting yourself off from whole universes of algorithms that were based on other mathematical principles that could run more efficiently, perhaps on a parallel machine. So one of the things that's happened now is that we have these parallel machines. We're discovering those algorithms, and we're actually taking advantage of them. And finally, I think there's as much to be learned about studying the properties of neurons and what neurons are actually doing, because after all, this is the only machine we know that actually solves the problems. So why turn your back on it, right? And this is particularly important, and I think we can learn we'll learn a lot by looking at those parts of the brain where nature really has had to work really, really hard to come up with the most efficient use of its resources. And early vision is probably a good place to start, especially the retina. And once you've understood these basic principles, that may give you some ideas for what the algorithms are. And then ultimately, that'll give us some ideas for what the computational strategies are. And I'm not advocating one way or the other. I'm basically saying you basically do it from the inside out. If you get an insight at the algorithmic level, test it to see if that's what the neuron is doing. Design an experiment. Or if you think that an algorithm can solve a particular type of computational problem, well, can this be the fundamental thing that the brain solves? For example, One of the things that Jeff Hinton and I did when we first started working on a particular algorithm called the Boltzmann machine was to realize that this neural network, which had symmetric connections and was able to use binary pulses, one of the things it could really solve really, really well were constraint satisfaction problems, where you had a lot of pieces of weak evidence and you need to come up with a global solution that would be the best possible interpretation of all these weak pieces of evidence. So that gave us the suggestion that really what the brain was doing was not solving a logic problem, but solving constraint satisfaction problems. So that puts you in a completely different part of the computational universe. Now that's probably one out of many different computations that the brain needs to solve, putting together a bunch of weak pieces of evidence, but there are many ways you can solve that. We now know there are Bayesian graphical models that can also solve that problem. So there are many algorithms, but it may be that finding these important principles are really the important things that we should be aiming for from getting ideas from all these different levels. Okay, so that was the philosophical part of the lecture. And so now let's dig down and go over what we've learned over the last 10 years to try to see, you know, to get us pointed in the right direction. Now, I know that John Reynolds has already talked to you about attention, right? How many people here heard his lecture? Okay, so you may already know, because it's an important lesson that guides his research, that our impression that when we look at the world, everything is perfectly crystal clear is an illusion. It's not true, right? We have to disabuse ourselves of that. And my favorite explanation when I was talking to my mother about it once, and, you know, she said, what are you doing, Terry? So I'm studying vision. Okay, well, what have you learned? I said, well, one of the things we've learned is that, you know, you can't actually see the world clearly all at the same time. Like, you know, a television set puts up the world clearly at the same resolution everywhere. She says, no, that's not true. You know, that can't be true. And she said, well, what's your evidence for it? I said, well, put your finger up here and you know, count the number of fingers. And she said, well, it's very easy. And she looked at it and said, two. Her explanation was that the world is clear no matter where I look. So it's simultaneously clear everywhere, because no matter where I look, it's clear, right? And that tells you, you've got this fantastic processor that on the fly can recreate any patch of the scene that you want to look at. And your ocular motor system is really fast. So it's an illusion that doesn't take any time. It does take time. And your eyes are bouncing around 3 times a second, right? Well, that's a completely different architecture, right? Now, here's a demonstration so that you can see for yourself. So this is a complex scene with a lot of parts and things. There's shadows here. What I'm going to do is to blink this once a second, and some part of this scene is going to change. And your job, it's an intelligence test, is to put up your hand when you see that change, okay? Okay, is everybody ready? Okay. Well, that's what I said, that if you've already seen it, if you haven't, but those who haven't seen John's lecture. Okay, so people are beginning to see it. So focus your attention on that nasal of the jet engine, right? Now, once you've seen it, it's impossible not to see it, right? And in fact, you know, you can see this a year from now and you'll recognize it. But without focusing your attention, that means fixating on it, or, you know, really focusing your internal attention, spotlight of attention on it, it's not apparent. And that's because you're not storing from one frame to the next, you're not storing the full high-res picture. You're just storing the few things you happen to be paying attention to. So that immediately tells us that the visual system isn't even in the business of reconstructing everything at the same time, right? Maybe it's reconstructing a small piece. Every time you move your eye, you're doing a little bit of reconstruction, and that then raises a lot of other interest. What kind of machine is going to patch those little things together so that you have an interpretation of the whole scene, right? Because you saw that was a scene. Now, one of the interesting things that comes from psychophysics, you can learn a lot, actually, by just seeing, is that if you briefly present a complex scene like that, say for 30 milliseconds, in fact, you can titrate it so that you can get to the point where you don't recognize very much about the scene, You can't report, for example, with any reliability what the objects are, but you can report whether it was outdoors or indoors, whether it was in the kitchen or the living room. In other words, what the brain seems to be processing first, if we interpret this as being the first thing that gets through in that brief presentation, is the global picture, the context. And later you fill in the details, right? So that's, again, a very different idea, because according to the bottom-up idea, right, you want to look at every little detail first. You know, you take all the features, and then you build up the objects, and then you build up how they're related, and then you build up the global picture. Well, it seems to be just the opposite, that we're getting the big picture before we actually fill in the pieces. This is a famous picture taken from the work of Jarbas. And again, you're visual, without any effort whatsoever, you can recognize that this is a face, right? And you can, there's a lot of information there that is implicit, that is immediately apparent. Like, for example, that this is probably a child, right? And that the child is happy, right? And recognizing expressions and interpreting age and so forth is something that we're all experts at. We've had a lifetime of practice at this, at figuring out, you know, who someone is, and from the kind of clothing they're wearing, you know, what their circumstances are like and so forth. And how do we do that? So what Jarbas did was to instrument for the first time the eyeball so that he could figure out where it was pointing at any given time. And this is a trajectory that was taken, and each of these little dots is a point of fixation. So here's a point of fixation, and then eye moves here, and then it moves here, and then it moves here, and then it moves here, and it moves here. And what you see is that a lot more time is spent on certain parts of the face, namely around the eyes and around the mouth area and around the hair. And those somehow are the ones that, so patching together these saccades, these patches, you're creating an internal representation of who that is. It's a person, it has certain properties, and so forth. But but that scan path depends on specifically what it is that you're trying to do. So here's another experiment that Jarbas did. A famous Russian picture called The Unexpected Visitor. So here's a scene. It looks as if there's a family. Someone has just arrived. And now you look at the scan paths under three different conditions. The first one, shown here, is what happens if you don't tell the person anything and you just have them look at it in a free viewing condition. And you find that it looks as if they spend a lot of time on the people's faces. And this, I think, may be the hand. Very high contrast feature. Now, if you ask a question, you ask them, okay, estimate the material circumstances of the family. And two, it's a completely different picture, right? They're not looking just at the faces. There's obviously some facial saccades, but there's also a lot of time spent looking at the background material, you know, pictures, table, chair, right? So what this is telling us is that vision is not a bottom-up driven activity primarily, although in a lot of experiments it is. Where you put a monkey, you strap them down, and you give them a stimulus, and they have to respond very quickly. Well, that's a reflex. You train the monkey to be a reflex machine. But if you ask a human being a question like this, what you're getting is the full cognitive power of the brain telling the eyes where to go, seeking information about the world, and trying to answer questions or estimate the ages of the people. Now you're really focused down, because the most information you're going to get is from, of course, what their face looks like. So this immediately tells us that the visual system has is very selective about where it chooses to put its processing power, and it's there. It has a limited bandwidth, and it's making sequential decisions on where to go next. where to go next. Okay, so now we're going to look for evidence from the physiological literature. And now we go back to Hubel and Wiesel, and we know from their work that if you record from neurons, and this one is an area V4 of the visual cortex, that the neurons there respond selectively to different patterns. For example, here's an experiment that was done by Bob Desimone and his colleagues back in 2001, where the monkey was fixated on a particular target, and the receptive field for the V4 neuron is actually in the upper little square here, and they have put a pattern in the middle of the receptive field, which is one that fires the cell, as you can see, at a high rate, 40 to 60 hertz when it appears. And there's another pattern just below the plant pointing fixation, which has a different feature outside the receptive field. And there are two conditions in this experiment, right? The sensory stimulus is going to be exactly the same. The only difference is the cue. The animal, the monkey, is given a cue to either pay attention to the top object or the bottom object.
Without moving its eyes.
And the task is actually to detect very small dimming of the intensity. So it actually doesn't even care what the pattern is. All it cares is whether it's changing. If it responds within a few hundred milliseconds of the change, it gets a liquid reward, right? Now, the beauty of this experiment is that the sensory stimulus and the motor system is doing exactly the same thing, right? The only difference is what the monkey is paying attention to. And what you can see here, shown in red, in the condition where the animal is attending to the neuron in the receptive field, is that the firing rate is a lot higher when the animal is attending compared to the blue curve, which is the response when the animal is attending to the bottom, right? Not attending, but the physical stimulus is the same, right? So this immediately tells us something. And we all know this. I'm going to assemble these pieces and then try to interpret what it all means. But this immediately tells us that the job of this neuron is not to represent what's purely what's out in the visual world, right? Because how it represents that object seems to depend on some internal variable within the animal itself, what the animal is trying to do with that information, right? And this occurs throughout the visual system. It turns out that people have found this not just in V4, but in V2, in V1, even in the thalamus, right? So this is something that goes all the way back to the earliest stage that has input, top-down input, coming from the cortex. So that's an important observation. So now we want to look at what's known about decision making. So here's an animal that's confronted with decision. Hot water or cold water, okay? It's something that many of you probably confronted many times, maybe even today, right? Now, let's think about this. Suppose that you have been out running, and you know you have been sweating, and you are very thirsty, and you come in. Which of the two are you going to press, right? Well, the cold water is a lot more appealing when you're hot, right? However, suppose that you've been out in, you know, nasty, freezing weather, right? Suppose you live in New York or Boston on the East Coast over this terrible storm that they had. You come in after shoveling, you know, 10 foot of snow, and what do? Well, the cold water isn't as appealing, right, as the hot water, because your thermostat, your body thermostat, is telling you that you want to warm up, right? What this is telling us is that the internal state, obviously, is going to determine your choice, but the question is how. How is that represented? And the traditional AI view would be, of course, you represent the water cooler vertically. The colors, everything gets passed on to the decision part of the brain, which then is going to be responsible for picking one of the two alternatives. Okay. Well, this is an experiment that was done by Paul Glimcher in one of these visual areas. It's the parietal cortex. And Again, it's going to be a very simple experiment. There are going to be two different blocks. And what you're varying here turns out not to be the sensory stimulus or the motor act. Again, what you're varying is the amount of reward. Remember I told you earlier, the way you get the monkey to perform for you is you promise it. It's a part of the deal that the experimenter has with the monkey that, you know, we'll give you a little drop if you get the right answer, if you press the right button. And that's how you train them. And then once they get to the point where they're really good at it, this is something that is they'll work for hours and hours and hours. That's their job. They do that for months and years. So let's vary the amount of juice. You know, this is not a big difference, you might think. Well, you know, the amount of juice. Well, you get twice as much juice. You know, maybe that's kind of nice. You have to work half as much. Maybe instead of 4 hours, you only work 2 hours that day. By the way, monkeys have enough juice, they stop working. They tell you, it's time for me to go to bed. Okay, so in block one, it's the when they move their eye to the right, when the lights come on, they will get twice as much as if they moved it to the left. So this is something that the monkey has learned over many trials, that in this block to the right is twice as much. But in the next block, it's going to reverse. So now you get twice as much juice if you move it to the left rather than the right. Okay, now what you're seeing down here is the firing rate of one of these neurons that is responding to the light coming on to tell for the monkey to start to initiate the eye movement. So here is the time when the target appears. And here's rastergrams for these two different blocks. And each of these is a spike. So this is about 25 trials in the condition when the monkey was moving to the right for a tenth of a milliliter. This is the visual response. And then after a few hundred milliseconds, there's a motor response when the monkey actually programs the cicada and moves there. So you can see that there's a visual and a motor component to the response in the parietal cortex. But now let's do the experiment for the results for block one. Here's block one, 25 trials in block one. And look at this. The firing rate to the motor movement is exactly same movement, same spikes. So the motor part of this neuron is the same. But the visual response is different by factor of three, 75 spikes per second here, 75 spikes per second here. This is exactly the same light, exactly the same motor movement. The only difference is the amount of reward the monkey knows it's going to get if it moves its eye there. But this is a visual response. How is the firing rate getting mixed up with the amount of reward, right? Does this make any sense at all? Well, think about the decision that penguin had to make, right? Wouldn't it be neat if your visual system, when it was sending information to the motor system, was telling you not just what's there, but the value of what's there for you, right? What if the value of an object is as important as its shape or its color? Right? And if you think about it for a few seconds, you realize that this would be a very useful representation if you had to survive in the world where, when you're hungry, you want to see things you could eat and forget about the nice green leaves and things. But if you want to leap through the tree, maybe you ought to attend to and value where the branches are, and because that allows you to survive jumping from limb to limb. And so I think what it's telling us is that, in a really direct way, that vision is impure. Vision is not in the business of segregating, analyzing in some abstract, platonic way the geometric properties of the world. It's there to help the animal survive. And including the value of the object at a very early stage of visual processing as an important part of the attribute of that object seems to be the way our brains are built. And, of course, it's going to change, right? So after, for example, the animal is satiated, when it's decided that you know, it doesn't need any more fluid, this firing rate is going to go down, right? And it's not as attractive. It's not as an interesting little piece of light. It's not going to want to move its eye there. So this is, I think, a very important observation, and it subsequently has been worked on by Bill Newsom and others, and really we actually understand a lot about how that actually comes about, and that turns out to be dopamine. And this might be a good place to take a break.
Yeah, I think that probably is, because we're sort of an hour in. So do you want to take a few questions, and then we'll have a little stretch, and maybe we can get a drink?
Okay, maybe just a few brief questions on what we've covered so far.
Okay, well, all right, Howard, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
How far down the visual system does the reward modulation go with respect to response properties? These were in parietal
cortex.
Does it go all the way back?
The attentional effects do. The dopamine projections are very dense in the prefrontal cortex and in the parietal cortex and in the striatum, less dense in the early stages of visual processing. So, but although there, you do get projections from which, what was that, Gary? Oh, okay. Thought you had something to say. But it turns out there are many other neuromodulators, for example, acetylcholine or epinephrine and so forth. We're going to be getting to that. It turns out that neuromodulators are one of the really important features that the cortex has for giving it information about what's relevant, something that's novel, surprising, important. These are all the neuromodulators, and dopamine is a particularly important one for reward. But there's a gradient, and so you get less and less of it. The amygdala, interestingly, is another one of these areas that is very important for emotional valence. How you know, not only is it valuable to you, but it might be dangerous, right? And that information turns out to be projecting back to V1, from the amygdala to V1.
And, you know, Carol Colby has seen a modulation of firing rate of LGN neurons as a function of task. So depending on the task, and they think that it's an acetylcholine effect. But
there's a very dense acetylcholinergic projection to the
thalamus. But, you know, for people who really thought that the thalamus at least is pure, turns out not so. Yeah.
Yes, John.
Philosophically, maybe Terry does. but I mean, what I think is really interesting about this, and you know, this is a major theme in Reed Montague's book. I don't know, many of you might have seen the review that Andy Clark did of Reed Montague's book in the recent Nature. But the idea that the reward system isn't just kind of an add-on, so that you end up choosing that, but kind of penetrates right down into the deepest levels of the various perceptual systems, means that certain, as it were, folk psychological ways of thinking about value are probably not right. I mean, at a certain very abstract sense, facts are facts and values are values. But from the brain's point of view, value's in there at the very basic and most, you know, rudimentary part of the story, because the brain's not so much interested in what's true. It's mostly interested in, you know, how do I manage to get a meal and avoid being eaten and so on and so forth. And so value has to be, and we think it is, of course, in the brainstem structures and the limbic structures, very deeply embedded in part of the story. And it's only when you get fancy like humans, where they can sit around and have the leisure to talk. They say, well, you know, fact is one thing and value is another. And at a certain level, that's true. But at a very deep level, it's not true, would be how I'd put it. I don't know, is that how, something like that?
Yes, and picking up, I read the review too. I thought he had a very interesting take on it, which was that in humans, it's not just objects that have value, but ideas can take on value.
Yeah.
And people become passionate, not about, you know, eating their lunch, but about a cause. You know, going, in fact, they're willing to become a suicide bomber if it's taken over their motivational system. So, you know, this, we're talking about very powerful parts of the brain that really have an important impact on our motivation and our actions, things that, you know, commitments that we make to the world. Okay, well, let's take a few minute break and then come right back. That the most important discovery that's been made in systems neuroscience over the last 10 years has been a discovery that was made by Wolfram Schultz about the function of dopamine pathways that have been studied for many, many years, first in rats and then more recently in humans. Now, these arise from a group of neurons in the brainstem, one group projecting up from the substantia nigra into the caudate putamen, that's the basal ganglia, and into the cortex, into the cortical mantle. And these are neuromodulatory neurons because they send their axons diffusely coursing throughout the entire cortex. And as far as we could tell, each of these neurons is carrying the same signal. So it's a global unimodal signal, a scalar. There's another nucleus, which is the ventral tegmental area, which has a similar function for the nucleus accumbens, the ventral part of the striatum, and the prefrontal cortex, very, very densely innervated with these dopamine neurons. What happens when these neurons die? And that happens when you get cytotoxicity. When they die, you get Parkinson's disease. And there are street drugs that you can take that also can kill them for you. And when that happens, you have a really interesting psychological phenomena called anhedonia, which is a lack of interest in anything that is pleasurable. In other words, you don't get any pleasure out of food, you don't get any pleasure out of talking with friends. In fact, you just become immobile. You don't initiate actions. So there's both a motor effect that Howard Poisner studies that evolved, you know, tremor, all kinds of problems with initiating actions. But there's equally very, very important changes that are occurring in the psychological state of the brain as well, the way that thinking patterns. So this is Wolfram Schultz and friend. Wolfram is on the right. So what he did was to record from these neurons. And at the time when he started doing these experiments, it was thought that they had something to do with the motor action, so that he tried varying the way that the animal would grip an object to see if that changed the firing rate of the dopamine neurons. And it wasn't until he started using learning problems where the monkey had to learn how to recognize a signal that it represents a rewarding stimulus that he finally started making progress. And here's the results of one of these experiments. So the idea here is that the monkey is sitting there, and unfortunately I don't have a laser pointer. I wonder if anybody has one that I could use. It might simplify some of my... Okay, well, I'll try to use this. Yeah.
Do you want a pen?
Well, if it's long enough, but... so here's the monkey, and there's a little yellow light bulb there, right? And when the monkey first starts the experiment, in order to get the reward, he has to take his finger off the key, but only if the yellow light is on. But when he starts the experiment, the yellow light doesn't mean anything to the monkey. It's just an arbitrary sensory stimulus.
Oh, thank you, Phil.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks. Okay, so there's our monkey. And here's our dopamine neuron. The dopamine neuron is firing at a low rate of about 5 or 10 per second. And before the learning, the dopamine neuron is responding to the reward. When the monkey actually gets the food, these neurons fire. So immediately every month, and this lined up with some of the work that psychologists had done that I'll tell you about later. So that makes a lot of sense, that the signal here is telling you something about a good experience. And not just to food, but to other things that are important for the animal. Now, little or no response to the light. That's before learning. After the monkey has reliably figured out there's a relationship between the yellow light and the food, the pattern shifts. The cell no longer fires, as you can see here, to the reward, but now it starts firing in response to the yellow light. Now, this could have been a green light or a red light, and the cell would have become selected for that different color or different, it could have been a sound. So what this illustrates is that somehow the light has taken over the properties that previously the reward had. The light, in a sense, is signaling the coming of the reward. And that turned out to be a really key, important insight because it ties in extremely well with a whole theory that had been developed earlier by Bartow and Sutton having to do with what they called reward with the actor-critic model. And very briefly, the idea is that you have a system that is able to represent objects and also represent their value. And that's the key thing. And that the value is something that can change with time. And that's, in the case of the brain, thought to happen through the dopamine system. And the dopamine system is basically the critic that's telling you whether or not this object is valuable, and when you get the reward, is it what you expected? And then they developed an algorithm called temporal differences, which can actually compute that online as the information is coming in. The idea is very simple. The idea is this, that the dopamine neuron is getting two things. It's getting a signal when you get the reward. You saw that at the onset of the learning. But you also are getting a prediction of the reward. Now, when you first start learning, you don't know whether it's going to come or not. And so when the reward comes, it's a bit of a surprise. You got it, right? But once you've learned the task, you can predict that you're going to get the reward. So what you do is you subtract it. And what you're giving with the dopamine neuron is signaling is not the reward itself, but the error of the difference between what you expected and what you got. And it's that error signal, it's the difference, is what's being used for updating your value representation, changing the strengths of neurons so that you can better predict in the future. That's the basic idea. And this is taken from a very nice review from Bill Newsom's lab, who's done a lot of the work recording from neurons in the parietal cortex, showing that, in fact, temporal difference learning actually can account for, remember the firing rate that you saw in that last the slide that we from Paul Glimcher's lab? You can very accurately account for if you vary the reward, for example, the probability of reward, the amount of reward, you can really predict what the dopamine neuron is going to be telling you. Very beautiful. Now, here's the smoking gun. So, great theory, but you've got to make a prediction. The theory has to predict something that you didn't see before. So here's the smoking gun, right? If the theory is true, that the dopamine neuron is getting two signals that cancel, right? The reward and the prediction. Then if you pull a trick on the monkey and don't give it the reward that it expects, then you're subtracting something from nothing. You should get a decrease in the firing rate, right? So you do these catch trials where the monkey doesn't get the expected reward. Here's the first part of the experiment. It starts out before learning with a reward signal, then it disappears. And now here are the catch trials where no reward occurs. And you'll notice that at the point where it is expected, there is a hole. The firing decreases beneath the baseline level. And this is really the key evidence that we have for the fact that the dopamine system really is in the business not of representing reward, but predicting reward. And by virtue of the firing decreasing, in fact, you can use that information to update your response to the next signal. The next signal, well, you're not expecting the reward quite as much as you did before. So that's, I think this is really a really critically important experiment. And it's really, I think, at the heart of a very important part of the brain that is important, we know, for motivation. Now here's the experiment that psychologists had done. I think this was first done by James Olds. What he did was to stimulate the dopamine system in a rat, put an electrode in, and had the rat choose between self-stimulating, releasing dopamine, or eating. Well, the rat started pressing the dopamine and really seemed to like that because it kept pressing. And even after hours and hours of self-stimulation, the animal still would prefer that to eating or anything else. In fact, the rat would continue doing that until it died. So it's clear that this has taken over the rat's brain. The rat doesn't have any choice anymore. It's going to die before it's going to stop being repetitively pressing that self-stimulation lever. Okay, well, we've got this dopamine system. what can you do with it? So here's a game that you can teach a monkey to play. This is something that Paul Glimcher did. See, games are kind of neat because unlike a stereotyped reflex reaction that you can train a monkey to do, you know, if it's round, you press button A, and if it's square, you press button B. You know, that's kind of an automatic kind of response. In the case of a game like this where you're playing a partner, you have to adjust your strategy. So strategy is as important in maximizing your reward, the amount of juice if you're a monkey, as getting the right answer, because it's not clear what the right answer is. And it may change, actually, during the game. In fact, that's part of the reason why this dopamine system is so important. We live in a world that isn't the same every day. It changes. It's uncertain. So you want to update all the weights. You want to change your response patterns depending on the conditions. So here's the game. We have the monkey playing against a computer. Of course, the monkey doesn't know who's actually it's playing against. It has to decide whether or not which key to press, two different keys, green or red. And here's the story behind the game, at least it's the one that you tell the humans when they're playing the game, right? The game is that you can choose whether or not to come to work, do an honest day's work. If you come to work, it costs you because you actually have to put your time and effort in, but you get back a little bit of money from the boss. Now, if you choose not to come into work and the boss doesn't check, you get all the money as if you did the work. However, if the boss checks you, you're out of luck. You lose money, right? Now, the boss, let's look at it from his point of view. It costs him to come in and check the employee. Now, if the employee's just working away, he's fine, doesn't have to come in. But every once in a while, he should come in and check just to be sure, because otherwise the worker is going to just stay at home and get rich. So the boss comes in and checks, the worker's working away, I've wasted it, my time and effort, But if he comes in and the worker's not working there, then the question is, how often should I come in? And how often should the monkey come in, right? And there's an answer to this mathematically. If you analyze this as a game, it turns out to be an equilibrium, which is optimal for both strategies. A strategy which is optimal for both the worker and the boss, it's called the Nash equilibrium. And here is a human now. The human, this is the proportion of times that you shirk. You don't come into work. And it turns out here, starting out about 50% of the time, the human will come in, and then eventually it reaches the Nash equilibrium, which is about 70%. And here you change the payoff matrix. You can change the amount of money that you're going to get, for example, for working, or in this case, for shirking. And here, the human, you can see within about, this is 100 trials, 200 trials, within about maybe 25 or 30 trials, the human has reached the new Nash equilibrium, which is more like 30%. So this is great. Human beings have, using their fantastic ability to reason and to be tricky, you know, shrewd, figure out what the right strategy is. But lo and behold, turns out monkeys are just as good as humans. In fact, they can make this shift. They can detect the change much faster than humans. Of course, they've been working at this for many, many weeks, and so it's not too surprising. But it's interesting, isn't it, that monkeys do the same performance, but there's a big difference. If you ask the human what was going on, each human has a story. The story will be something like, well, you know, I tried out a pattern where I go in every other day, but the boss figured out what I was doing, and then I decided what I would do instead is to sort of do it randomly, but somehow, you know, I wasn't coming in enough, and so I came in a little bit more. But he was really sharp. This guy was sharp. He knew when I was coming in, so I was, you know, second guessing him. Now, everybody's story is different, right? But their performance is more or less the same. And certainly, the monkey probably didn't have a story like that, right? At least he couldn't articulate it. And so we know now, recording from the dopamine neurons, that the point of equilibrium here is determined in large part by the amount of dopamine that you're getting in response to the reward, right? If you're getting more reward than you expected, then you adopt that strategy. You press the button again, and that turns out to be a way of the brain can solve games like this against opponents.
Did the humans get juice?
No, I think these are psychological experiments, and I think that there you get course grades, which are valuable.
Yeah, it's more valuable.
Different currency. Yes?
Are you saying the two different levels of equilibrium, the 70 versus the 30,
took place when the payoff shifted?
Yes. Without alerting anybody, you suddenly change the payoff for one of the matrix elements there, and that there's a new equilibrium, there's a formula for it.
And in both cases, was it at like 80 trials or something?
It was right about 100 trials. At 100 trials, yeah. Okay, so...
The monkeys anticipated the drop-off.
No, in the case of the human, here it's probably more like 80, yeah.
Okay.
But there's fluctuations here. It's not clear. It could have been a little bit further. But, statistics. Now, what's amazing about this behavior, which is embedded in all of our brains, is that you can find basically the same elements of this algorithm in honeybee brains. Honeybees are champion learners. They can go out and forage kilometers away, patches of flowers. They can figure out which of the flowers have the most nectar, and then they can take it back to the hive and, with waggle dance, tell other worker bees where to go. It's just phenomenal. And furthermore, they can make these assessments almost on a one-trial basis. They can learn from just a few examples, comparing the amount of nectar, even when the amount of nectar is variable and it changes from day to day during the season. So they're really, really good at this. And what they do is they associate the nectar that they get, the reward, with the color of the flower, the shape of the flower, and the odor. So these are the three things that we know that they are sensitive to, that they associate through conditioning. Now, the discovery that really broke this problem open was made by Martin Hammer, who was a postdoc at the time in Randolph Menzel's lab in Berlin. And I happened to be visiting the lab and actually saw the experiment being done by Hammer. What he had done is discovered that a particular neuron, which is the ventral unpaired medial neuron in the bee brain, which has its cell body right there, that this neuron would respond vigorously to sugar water, which is the positive reinforcing signal that the animal is using. And what you're seeing here, superimposed on a cross-section of the bee brain, is the axonal arborization. This is the output. So this is a diffuse neuromodulatory neuron, just like the dopamine neurons that spread out throughout the entire cortex, except here they're spreading out throughout the antenna lobe, that's the odor part of the processing system for the animal. And then the area here, which is called the mushroom bodies, you can see how nicely it outlines the contours of the mushroom bodies, which is known to be important for learning and memory in bees and other insects. And even here, a motor structure that's controlling the bee's actions. So here we have one neuron that is contacting a sensory structure, a motor structure, and a learning structure, and it's telling it something about the reward. Now, what they determined was that if you paired an odor with the sucrose, that after pairing it a few times, the odor itself would produce the very same response in that neuron. Furthermore, the neuron uses a transmitter, octopamine, which is a biogenic amine, which is a relative of dopamine. So this is amazing convergence. It turns out that the very same algorithm, temporal difference algorithm, can account for many of the properties of this neuron and bee behavior. For example, the fact that bees will avoid risks. If you give the bee a choice between a patch of flowers, for example, that has a variable reward, and another patch that has constant reward with the same mean, the bees will choose the constant reward and avoid the variable reward. And we can explain that with this model. So this was a model that was developed when Peter Dayan and Reid Montague were postdocs in my lab. And this is really the start for temporal differences in the biological world. It was from here that then we used a similar model to try to understand the dopamine neurons. And that led to testing it not just in monkeys, but also in humans using functional imaging. And so this is probably one of the best examples, if anyone ever asks you if computation has ever helped neuroscience, I think this is one of the best examples of a real synergy between a computational theory that was developed originally in the context of computer science and reinforcement theory, motor learning, and in a biological realm. So I'm not going to go into the details except to say that this is the algorithm. Delta T here at time T is the difference between the reward that you get at the next time step and the reward that you predicted from the previous time step. Now, the reason I'm putting it up is that there's two parameters in this model. One of them is the learning rate. So it's a very simple model, right? Two parameters. One is the learning rate, and it tells you how fast you learn. In the case of the bee, it's very fast, one trial learning. In the case of the rat, it's actually slow. Rats require tens and hundreds of trials to learn. So that means the learning rate is low. But the other factor turns out to be something called the discount factor. It's called gamma here. You notice that it multiplies the amount of reward that you are expecting on the next time step, right? And if you think about that for a while, it's a discount factor for the value that the reward has for you immediately compared to what you would get if it was given to you on the next time step. And in sort of colloquial terms, are you willing, if someone gives you a dollar tomorrow, is it as valuable to you as a dollar you're getting today? Well, no, obviously, because if you got it today, you could put it in the bank at interest, right? And therefore, if you want to get paid the same amount relative to the interest rate, you better be given more tomorrow. And that extends all the way into the future. Now, if gamma is 1, it means that that's equally important, that's equally valuable to you. And that means if you get a reward a year from now, it's exactly the same to what you're getting today. So what you're really asking is, what's my predicted reward for every single time step into the future, right? Gamma's 1. If gamma's 0, then this is 0. And that means that the future reward is worthless. If I don't get it right now, it's not worth anything to me, right? That's the 2 extreme. Discount of 1, discount of 0. And if you think about this, this can also vary, right, depending on if you're really thirsty, if the water is more valuable to you right now than if you're going to get it tomorrow, right? So this gamma factor is something that can be modulated as well. And the issue arises, well, if temporal difference learning really is what's happening in the dopamine system, then how is the brain representing the discount factor? Because we know that it changes human behavior depending on the value that the reward has, and therefore, there must be some brain structure or some brain system that might actually compute that. And so here's an experiment that was done by a Japanese group, and Kenji Doya, who was the computational person in that group, was also a former postdoc in my lab. And what they did was to design a game like the one I showed you, the work shirt game, except they designed a series of games that had different discount factors for maximizing the reward, right? So if you set it up so that you can get maximum reward by just taking greedily the option now that gives you the most reward now, right? Discount factor 0, that would be one game. But then you'd give another game where in order to get the maximum amount of reward, if you just took the greedy approach, you'd get less than if you took less at the beginning, and then later there'd be much bigger payoff, right? That's a gamma closer to 1, right? So you sit the human down in the scanner, you give it a couple of different games, and then you compare the patterns of activity. And is there a part of the brain that lights up? And the answer is yes. There's a part of the cortex that lights up and a part of the striatum that lights up. But what's interesting is if you color code the gamma factor that optimizes your reward for that particular game, it turns out that the region of the brain that lights up in the prefrontal cortex here and here is a gradient. So here is what lights up when you're solving the problem with the greedy algorithm, and here's the part, it's separated by several centimeters, that lights up when you're solving the problem with the problem that requires that you go through several rounds of punishment, taking something that's less important in order to get to a higher reward.
So what region are we actually looking at then in that second panel where there's the gradient?
This one here.
Yeah, so I mean, it looks like the cut is sort of like this way, right? I mean, it's not...
I think this is a cortical area. You'd have to look at the...
It almost looks like the insula.
It might be. Because this is a medial area that is lighting up. This one here is in the striatum. There's another part in the striatum that also has a gradient. Yeah, it could be the insula.
Yeah, because you're going to see it if the cut isn't here, but here.
Right, exactly. So these are sagittal sections.
Yeah.
And so this is more medial, and this is a little bit more lateral.
So if they showed that effect...
Right.
On this cut, you'd see...
This is coronal now.
Yeah,
yeah.
But if...
That's probably further
then
ahead.
Then that effect would be somewhere
right
in here.
Right, exactly.
Amazing.
Now, furthermore, it turns out that if you give drugs that block serotonin activity, you then block this nice gradient. So serotonin, which is another neuromodulator, is very important as well for controlling behavior, because we know that different levels of serotonin activity are associated with different levels of risk taking. So if you have a high level of serotonin, you tend to be more conservative and safe in your choices. As it decreases, you start engaging in more and more risky behaviors. And in fact, if you go to prisons, you discover that most of the inmate population have serotonin levels that are almost unmeasurable. You know, it's incredibly low, you know, because they're the people who have taken the ultimate risks. And furthermore, social hierarchies are also very highly correlated with serotonin levels. If you go to a monkey troop, the alpha males typically have the highest levels of serotonin activity, and the young males that are going around fighting each other are the ones that have the low serotonin activity. And by the way, that's what Prozac does, is it increases your serotonin levels. Yeah?
So when you say that serotonin mediates the gradient, how does it just mean that you can't use anything but the greedy strategy if you have no serotonin or something like that?
I think that it affects both the behavior and the pattern of activity. And we'd have to look at the papers in detail to see how that goes together. But the key thing here, again, that, and this clearly is something that needs to be followed up, because if it's true, it means that we have in our brain dedicated circuits for different types of strategies that might or might not be appropriate, right? If you're making plans for the future about your retirement, you want to be using this part of your brain, right? That's looking into the distant future. But, you know, if you're trying to save your life, you know, and you're need to make a very quick decision about, you know, what to do, because you're being attacked, then you know, you're going to be using that part of the brain, because it doesn't matter if you don't get out of the situation, there's no tomorrow, right? And especially with humans, see, humans, animals are probably all making these decisions and strategies depending on their overall, you know, life history. But you know, what's remarkable, this is also a case where you can get monkeys to train on this task, but they will only be willing to take so many steps into the future before they take the greedy strategy, right? They're just not capable of going through 10 steps of punishment before they get the result, the big payoff. Whereas humans, as far as we know, have no limit. In fact, they're one of the things I remember hearing when I was young was, Terry, you're going to get your reward in heaven, right? And people motivate their whole lives on the basis of principles like that. So that's clearly something that humans can really string out in terms of delayed gratification. Yes?
Quick follow-up. Then do we know, for example, do serotonin levels drop dramatically in like high pressure or sort of stressful fight or flight type of situations?
Good question. I think that serotonin levels are probably not varying. These are changing on relatively slow timescales. But one of the things that is well established is that serotonin levels go up if you're doing physical activity like running around, for example. You're very active physically, then serotonin levels go up. If you're sedate, they go down. And also the set points are also something that varies from human to human. Some people have set points that are high, set points, and it's always modulated around the set point. And probably, you know, with all these, there's about a dozen different neuromodulators, and they're highly correlated. The set points are correlated with your personality, whether you're a type of person who's very cautious or versus someone who's interactive and makes decisions very rapidly. Okay, so that's the serotonin story. Now I want to end with an example. So you might say, well, gee, this is great, you know, if you're trying to make simple decisions in life, which is just, you know, choose A versus B. But, you know, life is much more complicated. How could this simple system have anything to do with something as complicated as making rational decisions about your future when, you know, you have to take into account 10 different factors, right? Rationality clearly has to be important for that. And that's why AI really homed in on games early on, because of the fact that here you have many, many different factors you have to balance between strategies, for example, in games like chess and Go that are long-term and others that are short-term, and the balance between them is really important. So, and I should also say historically that one of the important turning points in cognitive science was when cognitive science turned its back on reinforcement learning back in the early days. I think there was a famous essay by Chomsky in the New York Review of Books where he said, "I can't imagine anything as complicated as language being learned using classical conditioning. Ha, ha, ha." And everybody said, "You're right. You're obviously the smartest man on the planet, and if you think it's impossible, it must be impossible." That was an argument from ignorance. And everybody believed him. They still believe him. Some people.
Used also was rather harsh.
Right. And you know, here's what we now are coming back to. This is basically TD learning was built as a model for classical conditioning, right? How far can you go with classical conditioning? What kind of problems can you solve with it? Well, what Chomsky couldn't imagine is that, yes, it's a simple learning algorithm and it seems to be universal in nature, but if you couple it with a really sophisticated, large knowledge store with lots of pre-computed strategies, you could use it in a very powerful way to select from all the different options you have which ones are appropriate for maximizing your survival, your rewards, from moment to moment to moment, very flexibly. So I'm going to illustrate that with a particular use of temporal difference learning algorithm in the context of games. And this is looking now, not at the complexity of vision, but the complexity of games. And what I'm showing here for three different games is the total number of possible game positions. So you can see that in backgammon, which is a very relatively simple game where you have a number of places and men that can go by virtue of throwing a dice, there are about 10 to the 20th different game positions. In chess, it's 10 to the 40th, and Go, 10 to the 80th, and it's roughly this order in terms of the complexity of the amount of time you need to master it and to become a grandmaster. So Jerry Tesoro, who's at IBM, and I first took a look at this game in the context of the early backpropagation learning algorithms. And what we tried to do was the following. We needed a teacher, right? An expert to score each of the different positions that you could move your men. So the men are white going in one direction, and then the red are going in the other direction. And there are rules about whether or not if you have two or more, you're safe. But if you have one, you can be hit and have to go back to the beginning. Very complex set of rules and strategies. But it's particularly difficult because of the fact that you have to roll a dice, which, of course, have many different combinations. And so on any given ply, there are about 40 different combinations of dice rolls and places that you could move your men. So for every time you want to look into the future, you have to go multiply by 40. So to go two ply is 40 times 40, 1,600 possible moves to think about. So you can't do what you do in chess, which is to be able to go down a tree, because you can only go a few steps into the future before you run out of the ability to keep track of all the possibilities. Now, what we did was to train a backpropagation network based on expert evaluations. We asked the expert to take each one of the moves from a given position and rank them. You know, is this the most important one? How would you rank it out of 100? 20, 30, 50. And we collected a huge amount of data like that. It was very expensive because, you know, labeling it means you have to sit there, and of course different experts disagree with each other, so it's inconsistent. But eventually we got a network that could play backgammon at an intermediate level, which is about where we were, right? Could play us pretty well. So we felt that was enough for a paper, and so we sent it off to artificial intelligence. And I guess it was good enough for artificial intelligence at the time. But Jerry went on to do something really clever. What he realized is that, first of all, we got to get rid of this expert, right? Who says that, you know, they're experts? Well, so let's have the game play itself. So the program is going to play itself, and it can play many, many games. And we're going to use temporal differences in order to evaluate the strength of the board in the same way that temporal differences is used, for example, for teaching a monkey or human, we think, to play the simpler game of work shirk. Now, there was a backpropagation network in it, which was computing the value function, but the update in terms of the evaluation for each of the board positions was being done on the basis of temporal differences. Now, when you first start playing with this, of course, the weights are random, so therefore the play is random. And it's not until you, by chance, one of the players wins that you get a feedback signal. The only feedback is whether you won or lost. You know, what could be more impoverished in terms of a stimulus than won or lost. But gradually, after a couple thousand games, you learn how to bear your men off at the end, and then after another couple of you know, tens of thousands of games, you get pretty good at the middle of the game, and then finally after a couple hundred thousand games, you starting to play a pretty good game. So this went through several different versions. The first version, after 300,000 games that the program played with itself, the program was beating Jerry, right? It was better than he was, so he couldn't evaluate it anymore. So he brought in an expert, a couple of experts, and one in particular, Bob Roberti, who's written one of the best books on positional play in backgammon. You know, what you do under the very special conditions and circumstances. And there's a lot of people, by the way, who play this for sport and for profit, just the way that people are playing poker now in the U.S. If you go to the Middle East, it's the most popular game. And I gave a talk recently at Jerusalem, and I started to explain the rules of backgammon to them, and everybody started laughing, and I couldn't figure out why. Of course, that's where it started, you know, and everybody plays backgammon in that part of the world. So here's Bob Roberti, and in out of 51 games, on average, it lost a quarter of a point, you know, if you get a point per game. If you win a game, get 1 point. Which is not bad. Roberti's a really good player, and he was impressed. He said, this is a pretty good program. It's really better than all the other game programs that were based on rules at the time. And then, of course, you know, the next year it got even better, and so he brought in some more experts, and now out of 38 games that it played with these experts, it was only losing 0.18 points per game. And then finally, he brought back Bob Roberti, after 1.5 million training games. And now, out of 40 games, it basically fought him to a standstill. And Roberti was floored, literally floored, because he did not believe a game could do a program that was just automatic, could do the things that this program was doing. Namely, it was making moves that no human had ever made before. And what he did was, he took all the games, went back and annotated them. Then they went back and checked, and what you do is a roll-off. You say, okay, if I go with this move rather than the human move, and I play many, many games, you know, who ends up winning? And it turns out that the computer, the program, TD, had discovered better positional play than the humans have been, have in fact assumed were the best moves. And there was another report, and I think this is probably, for me, not you know, whether or not you win or lose. I mean, chess programs, you know, now by virtue of the fact that you have computers that can play, you know, zillions of moves and then look, you know, 10, 20, 30 deep, you know, that they can beat humans, but it's not interesting, right? That just means that they can do more brute force search. But but if you examine the style of play, okay, so what Roberti and Woolsey and some of these others, Davis, what surprised them was how well T.D. Gammon judged the context, and they felt that one of the most difficult things for humans to learn requires a lot of practices, whether to be cautious in your moves or whether to be bold and aggressive. And there's a moment in the play where you build up your defense, and now you have to decide whether I should run for the exit or whether I should hold my, you know, positions to prevent the other person from getting through. And that is a very delicate decision to make, and the experts are saying that T.D. Gammon had mastered that. It was just brilliant at knowing that exactly the right moment in order to maximize the chances of winning the game. So now let's go back to artificial intelligence, right? So I think this is the first true sign of intelligence, that a program completely on its own has figured out the subtleties of strategy in a game that humans find interesting, right? And humans acknowledge this and respect it and use it, in fact, to sharpen up their game. So this seems to me a much more powerful way of dealing with an uncertain world than one in which you have to anticipate every single possibility ahead of time and encode it in terms of rules that an expert has to handcraft, which is the traditional way that a complex problem like this would be solved with artificial intelligence. And finally, now I want to end with a prediction for where this is all heading, because what we've seen is that we've come full circle. What we've seen that vision itself may not be as pure as we thought it was, right? That there's a lot of signals running around your visual system which are telling you not just the value of a particular object, but what strategy perhaps you should be using, right? These neuromodulators are telling you all sorts of very interesting information that you're using for guiding your behavior, for motivating you, for getting you to get up in the morning, for deciding, you know, whether or not you should study at night, or whether or not you're going to watch television, right? What is it that you're going to do with your life? These are all the big decisions. And as I said earlier, it's not at all clear when rationality and reason, obviously that is an important element in humans that makes them different from other animals, but the question is where and when is conscious reasoning important? So here's an experiment that was done just recently by a Dutch group. It was published in Science in 2006. And what they were interested in doing was to actually test this hypothesis. The hypothesis is that being able to reason about a situation helps you as the complexity of the problem gets larger, right? Simple problems, you might imagine, you know, where you just have two choices. Well, you can imagine a simple reinforcement learning algorithm helping you out there. But, you know, what if it gets to be really complicated, like, you know, buying a car where you have so many choices and so many features? Or getting married, right? Big decisions in life. Is that where rationality shines? Okay. So I can see that you know, testosterone may actually influence your choice in cars, and who knows. But here's the experiment. Okay, so what they did was they had people who went through a list of cars they could possibly buy, and each car had four aspects. Right, and then there were two groups. One group was given 10 minutes to go pour over the list and make the comparisons the way that you would comparison shop between all the features, look at the list. And the other group had a quick look at the list, and then they were asked to do some distractor task, which they weren't allowed to think about the list. But at the end of 10 minutes, they all had to make their choices. And then the question was, how well did they make their choice? Given that, in fact, there was one in there which was actually the best, and the answer is that you're a little better off if you have 10 minutes to think about it consciously, right? But not that much better, you know. So, but this is an easy task, which is four things. What if we make it more complicated? What if we have a list of 12 features now? You know, now the car has all kinds of options on it. You know, you can get you know, two-tone colors and things that are going to, you know, the features, the add-ons that the automobile dealers use to get their profits from you. And now, exactly the same two groups, one is able to look at the list for 10 minutes and the other one has to do something else. And now is where I think there's a big difference that becomes apparent. You're actually better off not looking at the list. The people who looked at the list and then came back to it later without consciously going over it in detail and trying to reason through, you know, comparing each pair of cars, was actually doing better at finding the best deal than people who were given all that time. And so here's my interpretation. It's kind of a surprising result. So,
do you have a question, Matt?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yes.
Quick question, because what I find most surprising about this is not even necessarily that in the second graph, that the unconscious processing is better, that it's even better relative to the unconscious processing when they only had four aspects.
So these are big error bars, and so the statistical significance of these two is probably not too different.
Okay,
so and you do have to look at the details of the experiment, so I'm just giving you the bottom line here. And they did a bunch of other experiments, and they all came up with the same conclusion. The conclusion is that as the complexity of a problem gets larger, that your unconscious processing, meaning what, you know, not actually thinking about it, is actually better than spending your time thinking about it.
Okay, but they don't find that it becomes also absolutely better, just relatively better.
They didn't report that. Okay. It's possible it does, but I don't think they actually focus on that. Okay. Now, so what's happening here, I think, is that ultimately the things that we weigh in life in order to make decisions are incommensurate, right? How do you trade off, for example, if you're going to live close to your work or farther away, we have to weigh off time, gasoline, cost. The house is more expensive if you're living closer. There's like all these dimensions, and it depends how valuable your time is for you, right? Some people, their time is, it always amazes me. Some people commute, 1.5, 2 hours each way, each day. It just boggles my mind, throwing away 4 hours a day. I mean, it's a big chunk of your day. But people do it all the time. Maybe less so now that gas is expensive. But the point, though, is that we're making these trade-offs all the time that are basically apple and orange trade-offs. But there, unless you have some way of putting it into a common currency, in other words, being able to convert it to something like a dopamine system that can, tell you how rewarding this experience is versus this experience, unless you have trained up a system with lots of experiences in the past of how you felt when you had to commute, how you felt when you had to pay at the gas pump, all integrated together in your cortical circuits, informing your dopamine system, right? That is what where unconscious processing is actually, where you're better off not focusing so much on the details as on the bottom line, as on how to integrate all that information, how to take all those different variables and weigh them. And that's not something that you're probably good at consciously. You don't really know how much your time is worth, right, until you don't have it. Right? We're not in the business of accounting for everything that we do. Our brains are. Our brain keeps track of everything that we do, and it's converting it into the common currency of dopamine. And I think, and this is what the experiment is telling us, is that your brain is better off doing this without getting confused by a rational system, which is sequential and is only good at comparing one or two things, a few features, but it does that very well. So I think that contrary to what you might have imagined intuitively, I think that our brain evolved in order to solve really complex problems where there's hundreds of variables that are involved having to do with the conditions of the weather and the conditions of the food supply and what the season is like, all the immensely complex decisions that animals make every day. Social decisions about, different people you're going to form alliances with. Very complicated. You can never write down a logical formula that's going to tell you whether or not to trust Putin, right? So, but we make those decisions, and so somehow our brain is designed to do that. Now, it's what's really nice, though, is that we have this extra system, this rational system, that when after coming and reducing the number of variables to one or two, can actually solve the end game, figure out how to get that last little bit out. It's fairly late in evolution. It's not something that's been perfected. We're not that good at it, right? But it's very valuable. There's no doubt. It's really important. But by far the most important things that nature has evolved and are found in all creatures, all models, are these basic neuromodulatory systems. These are the systems that help guide your behavior, get through crises, make sound decisions based on all of your previous experience, even if you can't articulate it. Because most animals, of course, have gotten by just perfectly without having that added capability. Yes?
So it sounds like, in a way, this is a bit like your Boltzmann machine of old, that although that one was concerned with all kinds of little bits of evidence, mm-hmm. using temperature, but it sounds like this is all kinds of bits of value of varying degrees, and in a Boltzmann machine-like way, it settles into
right.
some sort
that,
of...
So that's a really neat observation. So. Remember I told you earlier that constraint satisfaction was one of the things that we thought that vision might be important for vision, for being able to weigh a lot of weak pieces of evidence. And it's probably something similar now that is happening in the brain, because you can imagine that different parts of the brain are going to be focused on different aspects of the problem, right? Different features, different trade-offs. And because there isn't a direct connection between all the different parts of the brain. There has to be some way that the information has to be able to be integrated. And we know that there's projections of the entire cortex down through the striatum into the dopamine system, right, through the basal ganglia into the ventral tegmental area. So this is like a funnel that's, in principle, can respond to any part of the cortex, and you can learn which parts should be weighed for each problem, which parts of the cortex are more important. And you've built up that kind of constraint satisfaction through experience, through ways that, comparing how much reward you got from a particular experience, and then integrating that throughout a lifetime of making these decisions. And so I think there's a similar kind of a principle that may emerge ultimately when we actually figure out how the integration actually takes place. And people are actually following up on that. One of the things that you might be amused at is the following, that so if this is true, right, then there may be something to the adage, let's sleep on it. Because sleep is a time when we know you're unconscious. And you're not aware of what's going on in your brain, except the dreams that kind of intrude every once in a while that you don't remember, right? But it could be that, in fact, if you're really struggling with a really hard problem and you're looking at all the nooks and crannies with your conscious spotlight, that the best thing that could happen to you is a good night's sleep, when the different parts and constraint satisfaction could be occurring through different sleep stages, slow wave sleep, for example, where the different parts of the brain are kneaded together, and then when you wake up in the morning, suddenly, bang, it becomes clearer to you what the right strategy is or what not to do or how you should proceed. And that's something that I think is very magical, that if we could understand what's going on in the brain during sleep, we might actually have a way of studying this phenomenon in a pure way. Because, of course, when you're awake, you're always, your unconscious mind is always working in the background, but it's something that has to also work side by side with your train of thought, right? And your train of thought may actually lead you to make bad decisions, so you have to be careful not to talk yourself into something. Yes?
Do you think that gut reactions, is that just a metaphor, or do you think there's something to notions of...
Well, I think that... who wrote a book about this?
Malcolm Gladwell.
Right. Was it Blink?
Or Blink. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very interesting book, but I would say that I would be a little bit cautious, because the gut feeling is probably only going to be reliable when you've had lots of experience and you happen to be an expert in this area, right? In other words, your ability to make rapid decisions doesn't come instantly, right? Someone who's new to an area, they make lots of mistakes, they're not aware of the pitfalls. But if you take a doctor, for example, when they go through medical school, they learn all these rules about, you take the temperature, and if it's high, then you test for this, and then if it's that comes up positive, then you treat the patient this way. And there are all these rules of thumb that you pick up that get you started. But if you take somebody who's a champion diagnostician, they come in and they're already making their diagnosis by looking at the patient. They can already tell you, what's likely to be the case, because of the fact they've had so much experience with so many different people under so many different circumstances that their gut feeling is almost infallible. And now all they're doing is just checking to see if their hunch is correct. They go and they test the particular thing that they think is the most likely. Now, if for people who are just starting, that's probably the absolute wrong thing to do, because their gut isn't as well practiced yet. Right? So, any other questions? You're just yawning?
Is it over?
If you'd like it to be over.
I'll have time for a few questions. I know some people need to leave around 4, so if you need to leave, feel free to go, but there can be additional discussion.
Yes?
So I really like all of this, and I agree with it, most of it. definitely you made the point that attention is important, that the call is internal variable, that eye movements are important, that vision is not just pure, it involves many factors like motivational factors, emotional factors, reinforcement learning and rewards, all that. But all of those factors are kind of slightly separate from vision itself, because you could, for example, think of a blind person that has absolutely no vision. They don't see anything, but they have all those other factors, maybe not visual attention, but they'll have auditory attention or something else. And I agree that all of those factors are really important to make robots that in the future will actually be able to be well-motivated visual agents. But the original quote that you had to do with issues of non-uniqueness in vision, of incomplete information. The fact that we have two-dimensional world and we make Bayesian inferences, probably based on some empirical Bayesian thing, to make a model of the world. And for example, to locate ourselves in space and to locate other things. So I wonder if those things can also be, vision itself can be thought also as an internal state.
Well,
for example, in dreaming.
So you raise...
In dreaming, you have vision.
Well, let's go back to the comment you made, which is fascinating. What about blind people, right? So there was a report that came out just recently showing that blind people can see by listening to reflections of sounds off of walls. They get very sensitive to things that we ignore. The fact that when you're in a room with walls that are close together, reverberation time changes, right? And, they can tell whether there's something in front of them. And so it's possible to use cues, right, from many different sources. The parietal cortex, by the way, is the area I was showing you. In fact, is the area where information comes in, not just from the visual system, but also from the auditory system, from many other systems. It's where the information is integrated to create a model, but not a model in the sense of a perfect internal kind of dollhouse of the world, but rather a model in the sense of being able to perform transformations from one population of neurons representing spatial information that's derived from the auditory or visual sense or somatosensory, and that population and another population that's going to need to move your limbs. And the only thing that you need is to know the transformation. You don't need to have a veridical model of the distances between points. All you need to know is how to go from this group of neurons to this group of neurons. And you can do that through a network. And the question is, which parts of the network are going to be communicating to what other parts of the network, right? It's not just one group of neurons, it's a lot of different neurons. But the other thing, of course, is that, and this is a very, very dramatic, the McGurk effect, and this came up actually in our book chapter. We many, many examples of how one sensory stream can actually influence the percept of another sensory stream. So in the case of the McGurk effect, you have the sound of someone saying ba da ga, and then you have the mouth video of them. But if you mismatch the ba sound with the ga mouth, you hear da. You close your eyes, you hear ga. Open your eyes, you hear da. And it's not just you hear the difference. It's not like you're seeing the difference, you're hearing it. And in fact, it was even amazing because I saw Pat Kuhl give this demo once, and it even works if you look off to the side. You don't have to be fixating the mouth. This is really, and we're not aware of this. We're not aware of the fact that we're using visual cues all the time to guide our auditory sense and vice versa. Again, you can't trust your intuition. We're not designed to come up with the truth about how nature designed the system. It works in a way that we have to discover through experiment.
So just to follow up, the last thing I said was about dreaming. So in dreaming, both vision, auditory, somatosensation, all your senses are literally disconnected from the outside world. The thalamus has been, So in those states, you have all of this conscious or whatever you want to call it, REM perceptions. Maybe they're not the same as what we have right now, but they're very similar, at least we can say. So so from that perspective, it seems that those states of vision, they're internal states, like the attention, like the rewards, the motivations, the pure vision itself, it seems to be like an internal state that your brain just evolved to be able to generate.
Well, if your perception of what's out there is just a pattern of activity in neurons and scattered around different parts of your brain, and if during sleep some input can recreate that pattern, then it will have perceptually the same impact. But that doesn't mean that it's any more, it's not any less of an illusion than the real world is, right? This is just turning on the grand illusion during the night. But you know, it is disconcerting that our intuition is so unreliable, right? We seeing is believing, right? You've got to see the graph, and you've got to see the data, and so forth. So I think that it what's going to happen when we finally figure out that, you know, when seeing is not believing, right?
Well, if our eyes didn't have lenses, for example, they have a two-slit or something like that, then we would have a very different...
So you're talking about virtual worlds.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are people actually who spend a large parts of their life now inhabiting not this world, but a computer world that's constructed totally from, you know, bits of information in some computer, where they buy computer-generated clothing. And the more money they have, by the way, you know, the virtual money, the more virtual money, the better the design that they can buy. And they go around strutting their stuff with their avatars. So it's amazing what our brain can adapt to. The conditions that were, you know, never, you know, you can create any universe that you want inside of the computer. And you know, ultimately, we'll be adapting to it.
So one thing, I guess I don't quite... I can't quite see my way clearly to, is when you have competing values, so temporal difference learning has, you know, geared up for this, and it's also in a different condition geared up for that, and then as luck would have it, these two sorts of conditions obtain at the same time, and now I have competing values. So just, you know, roughly speaking, how do you see that, I mean, or should we think of this kind of on a hydraulic model, you know, that this one just is kind of stronger than this one? How do you think about that?
So one of the principles of cortical processing that we can see embedded in neurons is competition.
Right.
So, and this is a John, I think Reynolds may have mentioned something about this. The idea is that at the highest levels, you have relatively low bandwidth in terms of the number of things that can be fully represented, maybe just one or two things, right? But which one or two is it going to be, right? Well, it's funneling in, and then the two fight it out, and you can bias it. So he thinks of attention as a bias, as a way of just enhancing the signal-to-noise ratio for one of the streams versus the other, giving it a competitive advantage, winning on that particular moment, so that now you can fully analyze that one little object, right? So you can imagine that the brain also has to has competing inputs that are going to compete for the value calculation, right? So they may be incompatible. Maybe they're actually we know this. Humans can in the very same brain, you know, believe completely opposite things in different contexts, right? So one context, this is the winner. In another context, this is the winner. They're both there, and maybe they're both adaptive for the different contexts. But what happens when, you know, you try to do it in an abstract way and start saying, well, which is better, or which is the right way to do it? And now you're in trouble, because you have to, those two now are going to have to, you know, fight it out for control of one system. So ultimately, because you can only have one behavior, you can only choose one thing. You can't. You have to go, you know, the motor system is what ultimately takes you into a sequence of states that you can process lots of things in parallel, you know, information coming in, it can be weighted, competing, but ultimately the basal ganglia filters that out and decides ultimately, well, I'm going to move my hand here first, and then second, I'm going to pick this up, and third, I'm going to do that. Now, you don't actually think about that, but somewhere in your brain that has to be decided. And similarly with deciding on what action to take depending on what your value system is, surely the basal ganglia is going to have to take into account similar kind of constraints. Okay?
Where can these values from?
What was that?
You talked about the values. Where they come from?
Values. Where do values come from? Well, Pat has thought a lot about this one.
Well, I guess the basic values. I mean, this is going to be kind of hand waving, but I mean, the basic values are presumably determined by the way the brainstem is configured, so that you're going to care about temperature, you're going to care about food and water, and you're going to care about your own survival, and you're going to care about sex and about offspring and about mate attachment. And then as a function, I'm sorry, this is so terribly vague. I mean, it sounds like I don't know what I'm talking about, of course, really.
You're talking about the hypothalamus.
Well, the sort of...
Those are all things that are...
The surface. Hypothalamus, the amygdala, the brainstem, and the various structures that constitute the limbic system or the limbic structures. They're going to set the basic values, and then, of course, as a function of your experience, then other things are going to come. You're going to value not being the lowest guy in the hierarchy, and you're going to value certain kinds of bonding with kith and kin against others, and you're going to value a book rather than a piece of chewing gum, and so forth. So I think but the basic values, and by the way, I mean, I think about this with regard to moral values also. The basic values are really all set, and then the fine tuning is going to occur later, so that in the domain of moral values, and here, I just feel like I'm at the very beginning of trying to understand this. The social values, the love that you feel for a mate or for your children, I mean, that's all, vasopressin and oxytocin in certain parts of the brain, the pallidum and the septum and so forth, just in there doing its stuff. And
so, Pat, do you really believe that love is a peptide?
Yeah. What else would it be?
So, by the way, for those of you who are interested in this area, John Ullman will be giving the Francis Crick Lecture at the Salk Institute at 4 p.m. on Friday, March 16th. You're all invited.
Do we have a seminar that day, or are we over? Because you surely must go. I mean, that will be a sort of, life experience, and you'll be able to say to your grandchildren, I went and heard the great John Ullman, and so forth. So you really must go to it. And if we have a seminar that day, perhaps I can, reschedule.
Well, we just start 50 minutes earlier so that people can walk over.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I think I just read the last day of classes is the 15th. That might be wrong.
That must be wrong, because that would make Saturday the 16th.
No, 15th?
The 15th is
a Thursday.
Is a Thursday?
And 16th is a Saturday.
Okay. All right, it's a Friday.
It might be the last day.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I'll check.
Yes.
Thanks, Adele, because I may well have it completely confused. But yeah, it would definitely be...
March 16th is a Friday. It's week 10, so it would be the last week of classes.
All right, so we are really scheduled to have Dennis O'Leary talk to us about, that will be the second part of the How Does the Brain Get Built story. So let me email you all, and I'll find out if we can just make it a little bit earlier, or else we'll just cut things a little bit short that day, because you must have time to get over to hear John Ullman.
Okay, well, good. Thanks
great.
So much.
Thanks a lot.